Hello, this is the NPR News Update Podcast, Minnesota's news on your schedule for Thursday, February 28th. I'm Phil Picardi. Coming up, we hear arguments for and against Governor Dayton's tax overhaul proposal. State officials worry how they will pay for a new Viking stadium. Some people in state custody may have been held longer than necessary. And Lake Mille Lacs area folks sound off about a plan to cut fishing there in half. First, the February budget forecast shows a projected budget deficit of $627 million. That's an improvement of $463 million from the November budget forecast that showed a projected deficit of $1.1 billion. State lawmakers will use the forecast to shape their budget decisions this legislative session. The DFL governor's sweeping tax overhaul proposal would raise about $2 billion in new revenue. It got its first public hearing last night. The plan to raise income taxes on top earners and expand the sales tax while reducing property taxes drew passionate reactions. Rupa Shenoy was there to hear what people think about Governor Mark Dayton's plan.
Hundreds of people showed up for the tax hearing, and the overflow crowd filled several rooms. The turnout delighted DFL State Representative Ann Lincheski, chair of the House Taxes Committee.
This is so nice to see people that we don't know.
Throughout the hours of testimony, members of the public spoke to the committee about specific details in Dayton's plan that affected them, their families, and their businesses. Those for and against the governor's package appeared equally represented. Among those in favor of Dayton's measures, doctors said they support a proposed increase in cigarette taxes. A driver who transports the disabled hailed Dayton's suggested transit tax. Mark Lukoski of the Minneapolis Firefighters Union said Dayton's proposed increases in local government aid were desperately needed. Lukoski said over the past few years, cuts to local government aid have devastated fire departments. He said they're now working with skeleton crews and response times have suffered.
I guess I would put it to you is if your child's choking on the marble, for example, you want three people there or four people working on this? You want that person there in 3:39? You want us there in 5 minutes?
Another supporter, Lutheran pastor Paul Erickson, said government is not the enemy and taxes aren't evil if they pay for a quality education.
We cannot sit idly by and watch our children being deprived of the very things they need in order to achieve their fullest potential. We need to strengthen the tax base, making sure that all individuals and corporations pay their fair share, and Governor Dayton's proposals go a long way toward doing just that.
People who spoke against Dayton's plan said it put jobs at risk. Many business owners said the proposed 5.5% tax on business-to-business transactions would cripple local economies. Molly Youngbauer owns a St. Paul IT consulting firm with her husband, which employs 200 people.
Please think about it this way. Millions of dollars will be added to the current cost of providing services. Health insurance will go up. Education tuition will increase. And the overall cost of local government will rise.
Doug Spong, president of a Minneapolis marketing firm, said such a tax would crush the artist community.
This tax, as it's proposed today, would be absolutely devastating to the state of Minnesota. There is no other state, in this country that taxes creative services firms. We do not want to be the only state doing that. That will cripple a thriving creative economy.
Architect John Strakota said the professional services tax would be an undue burden on his industry, which is just emerging from the recession.
So this will just begin to eat right into that recovery immediately.
At least one business owner spoke in favor of Dayton's proposed tax increases. Robert Scarlett identified himself as president of a business that helps exporting companies.
I don't feel at all bashful about suggesting that we need to invest more, and I believe the tax proposals before us are very fair and balanced.
The public hearing was just the first step in a long process.
Rupa Shenoy for us there. Now Tim Nelson. As electronic pull tabs miss revenue targets to fund construction of a new Minneapolis football stadium, Tim says lawmakers are increasingly interested in alternatives.
As revenue goes, electronic pull tabs have proven a shaky bet for Minnesota. Matt Mossman is the state's deputy revenue commissioner, and he offered some insight into how shaky when he appeared before the House Commerce Committee last month. Mossman said revenue projections for the state's stadium financing plan were falling short mostly because of how slowly the games were coming online.
The assumption at the time of the end of session was 2,500 sites in the fall, so as of October, and now the assumption is now 2,500 sites by July 1st of 2013.
As he spoke, there were only 111 sites up and running. Minnesota Gambling Control Board Executive Director Tom Barrett then told lawmakers that even the state's new expectation would have to be lower.
I don't believe we're going to be at the 2,500.
The latest figures show the state adding just two more sites per day at the time. At that rate, Minnesota wouldn't hit the 2,500 site target for bars with electronic pull tabs until 2016. Despite such testimony, though, most lawmakers have been reluctant to reopen a hard-fought stadium finance agreement from last spring. Most lawmakers. Republican Representative Tom Hackbarth of Cedar says he's planning today to again introduce a measure allowing slot machines at horse tracks to bolster state revenue. He says otherwise, regular taxpayers might have to make up the stadium funding shortfall.
So we are going to have a hole in the budget if the pull tabs don't bring the money in. So we have to have some money from some source. Sure, I think Racino is a good supply of money.
Hackbarth's Racino plan has fallen short at the Capitol repeatedly in the past, but less drastic changes to electronic gambling or other changes to stadium financing could shape a compromise to get stadium funding back on track. For their part, pull tab suppliers say they'd be interested in some limited changes, but say it's still too early to judge the electronic games. John Weaver is founder of Express Games, the first company to offer electronic pull tabs in Minnesota.
My first statement would be patient. It takes a while to adopt new technology, but once it's adopted, you always say to yourself, how did I ever live without it?
Others, though, say they think the solution to a shortfall in gambling revenue is to add more gambling options. Omaha-based International Game Co., a longtime paper pull tab maker, is poised to start selling its electronic game. Vice President Scott Henneman says his company already sells paper pull tabs to the state's regular pull tab distributors and that using long-established sales outlets may be the key to overcoming resistance to new technology among charitable gambling operators.
So we believe that their relationship with their existing charities, that those charities are waiting for a product to be manufactured by our company, but also to be offered to distributors that they're comfortable doing business with.
Henneman also has what he's pitching as the killer app of electronic charitable gambling, a linked bingo game. John Smolik runs Electronic Game Solutions, creator of the device that will run the bingo and pull tabs. Smolik says Linked Bingo in Minnesota will offer five-figure jackpots on games that play out on big-screen TVs in bars across the state.
The risk-reward is huge versus a pull tab where you put in $3 or $5, you get a chance at $14.99. You put in $3 or $5, you get a shot at $25,000, $50,000, $74,000, whatever it may be.
Several bingo games could be approved by March 18th. The state still has time for all the games to ramp up. Finance officials say they aren't likely to sell stadium bonds until this fall and start paying the stadium mortgage after that.
Tim Nelson there in St. Paul. Lawmakers have launched a long-anticipated effort to legalize same-sex marriage in Minnesota. DFL Senator Scott Dibble and DFL State Representative Karen Clark, both of Minneapolis, are the chief authors of the bill. If passed, the measure would remove a prohibition in current state law and allow same-sex couples to begin marrying August the 1st. Clark says Minnesotans spoke loudly in November when they rejected a proposed constitutional amendment banning gay marriage.
It was a very clear statement, and I think we're now ready to take the next step, and it means everything to our families. It means everything in terms of the kinds of responsibilities and accountabilities and rights that we will be able to exercise in the future. And I want to thank all Minnesotans for helping bring us here.
A group of Republican lawmakers claim the measure would redefine the institution of marriage in a radical new direction. GOP Senator Warren Limmer of Maple Grove says Democrats have misinterpreted the constitutional amendment vote.
It is in no way a mandate from the people of Minnesota. The people simply said that they didn't want to include the definition of marriage as it's written in Minnesota state law and include it in the state constitution.
Republican Senator Brandon Peterson of Andover is a co-author of the legislation, but he did not attend yesterday's news conference promoting the bill. The legislation, which includes an exemption based on religious beliefs, is getting formally introduced in the House and Senate today. It's the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. Hundreds of people with mental illness remain in state-run psychiatric facilities for months or even years after they're ready to return to the community. That's according to a lengthy report released by the Office of the Legislative Auditor. Madeline Barron has covered the story, and she joined Tom Cran to talk about it on All Things Considered.
So give us the overview here, the headline. What does the report say?
Well, in short, it found that there was widespread failure by the very top leadership at this Department of Human Services to manage all of these programs that provide services for people with mental illness, chemical dependency, and developmental disabilities.
At facilities around the state?
Right.
Now, give us some examples here.
They found that more than one-third of the patients at a state hospital in Anoka no longer needed to be there, but the state had failed to find appropriate places for them to live, so they were just stuck there, even though, you know, they didn't need a hospital level of care. Another example comes from the Minnesota Security Hospital. That's the facility in St. Peter that provides treatment for about 400 adults that are committed as mentally ill and dangerous. And the auditors found that the facility provides little or no actual treatment. For example, they looked at the average activities of patients. So in any given week, they found patients had just 16 hours of scheduled activities. And these are some of the people, they're supposed to be some of the most mentally ill and dangerous people in the state, 16 hours of activities a week. And what those activities were things like library visits, working in a wood shop, recreation, hobby-related courses, and only slightly more than 1 hour of anything that you could call actual therapeutic activities a day for these patients.
Now, those problems have to do with the operations of these facilities, but they also found some problems with the state's civil commitment law itself as well?
Right. So under state law, you can be civilly committed as mentally ill and dangerous for what's called an indeterminate length. So basically for the rest of your life, maybe. And there's nobody that's going to come in and review that unless you request it. So you could be at the Minnesota Security Hospital for the rest of your life. And what these state auditors found was that that actually might be in violation of a patient's due process rights under the Constitution, that they need to have, they're entitled to a review of their commitment to make sure that they still should be committed.
Now, remind us why this audit was conducted in the first place.
Right. This audit, lawmakers had requested this last year from the Office of the Legislative Auditor. And what they wanted was the auditor to look at the Department of Human Services state-operated services division. And that's the division that provides all the actual treatment for people with mental illness, like I mentioned, chemical dependency, developmental disabilities. And this ranges from really small group homes to really large facilities like the Minnesota Security Hospital. What lawmakers wanted to know was, how does this really massive agency manage all these programs, and could some of these programs be better handled by private companies?
Now, any recommendations from the auditors in the report?
Yes, they released 20 recommendations. They said that the legislature should clarify what state-operated services is really supposed to do, that even that is unclear. They said that it's possible that some group homes for people with developmental disabilities could instead be run by private companies. They said that the department has a responsibility to make sure that there are housing options for people that are ready to leave state hospitals. And they also said that the legislature should amend state law to provide a regular review of these civil commitments for people who are mentally ill and dangerous.
What sort of reaction have you been hearing from lawmakers?
Well, this was released in committee this morning, and lawmakers on both sides said they wanted to see more information from DHS, both now and going forward. Several lawmakers said that DHS needs to be more transparent. They said DHS over the years has failed to provide really basic information about how it runs its programs and how it measures its progress, and they want that to change.
And what about from the Department of Human Services? I understand you spoke to their head, Lucinda Jessen.
Right. Commissioner Jessen told me that she agrees with all of the recommendations in the auditor's report and says that DHS is already in the process of making some of these changes. And she also noted that some of these problems they're trying to fix in the Governor Dayton's proposed budget. There's money in there for transitional housing, for example, for patients.
Madeline Barron, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Madeline Barron there with Tom Cran last night. A new report shows the rate of children sent to juvenile detention facilities has actually dropped dramatically over the past decade. Laura Ewan says Minnesota is one of five states with the sharpest declines.
But the report by the Justice Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. also found a troubling trend. Kids of color continue to be locked up at higher rates than white kids. Brian Smith coordinates the Juvenile Detention Alternatives Initiative in Minnesota. He thinks the justice system here is making strides to treat non-whites the same as whites after they've been arrested.
However, I still think that the number, the sheer number of kids that we touch from certain communities contributes to the disproportionality when you get to the number of kids who are in jail.
He says more work needs to be done to determine if police target neighborhoods in such a way that leads to higher arrest rates for young people of color.
That's Laura Ewan in St. Paul. Minnesota school districts are preparing for a reduction in their federal funding if across-the-board spending cuts called sequestration go into effect tomorrow. Here's education reporter Tim Post.
Most Minnesota districts expect a 5% cut in their federal funding through sequestration. Those cuts, mainly in funding for special education and programs for low-income students, would go into effect next school year. But the cuts would be bigger and more immediate for schools on Minnesota's Indian reservations, which rely heavily on federal funds. Steve Wymore is superintendent in Red Lake, where $8 million of the district's $24 million budget comes from the federal government.
You start affecting a third of your budget, it has a major impact on how you operate.
If the budget cuts go forward, Wymore is planning for a $1.6 million reduction in Red Lake's federal funds, or about 9%. He says that could require staff layoffs and higher class sizes.
Tim Post on the NPR News Update. The city of Duluth has sued the federal government as part of its long-running dispute with the Fond du Lac Ojibwe Band over revenues from its Duluth casino. Dan Crocker explains.
The city filed suit this week against the federal National Indian Gaming Commission, or NIGC. 2 years ago, the NIGC ruled that the revenue-sharing agreement between the band and the city of Duluth violated federal law, which requires that Indian tribes retain sole proprietary interest of their casinos. Starting in 1994, Duluth received about $6 million a year from the downtown casino, but in 2009, the band stopped paying. This latest action comes after Duluth lost a round in a federal appeals court last month. In that case, Duluth had sued the band after it stopped making revenue-sharing payments. Duluth Mayor Don Ness has said more than $12 million that the band has withheld is at stake, plus millions more in future revenues.
Crocker in Duluth, now Elizabeth Baer in Rochester. She says the Mayo Clinic reports a large decline in the bottom line last year, but officials still call the results a solid financial performance.
Mayo brought in nearly $8.8 billion across its hospital system last year. That's 6% more than the year before. But the clinic also spent more money. Mayo officials report the hospital system had $395 million in net income in 2012, nearly 35% less than the same period the previous year. Chief Financial Officer Jeff Bolton says that drop in net income was intentional and partially the result of a diversion of nearly half a billion dollars to the pension fund.
We ended the year one plan. We have a very aggressive plan for this year, both in terms of volume growth, and expect to hit that plan.
Mayo leaders also highlighted the clinic's multi-billion dollar proposal to make Rochester a global medical destination.
Liz Baer there in Rochester. Now a couple of environmental stories. Researchers trying to pinpoint the effects of sulfate on wild rice will update the public on their progress tonight. Here's Stephanie Hemphill.
Sulfate is found in the wastewater of mining operations and sewage treatment plants. The Minnesota Pollution Control Agency is considering changing the state's current limit following complaints by industry that it's not based on sound science. UMD biology professor John Pastor helps lead the research. Pastor says the data so far indicate that the state's current limit of 10 parts per million is in the right range.
All three of them are kind of pointing to somewhere in the range of 10 to 100 parts per million of sulfate, you start to see effects.
Pastor's lab experiments also yielded surprising data indicating that sulfate itself may harm growth even without being converted to sulfite by bacteria in sediments. He's still perfecting experimental methods and results aren't expected until the end of the year.
That's Stephanie Hempel. Now we close out the podcast with a look at a fishing conundrum on one of the state's most popular lakes. It was standing room only at a town hall meeting last night on the north side of Mille Lacs in central Minnesota. The topic, how to manage what the DNR says is a walleye population at its lowest point in decades. Conrad Wilson says agency officials heard from area residents and business owners about how regulations could impact the Mille Lacs community.
The name of the game on Mille Lacs this year is small walleye friendly.
Small walleye friendly just means setting regulations that don't target small walleye and setting other regulations for other species that might increase their survival.
That's Tom Jones, the treaties manager for the Department of Natural Resources.
We want to put in a suite of regulations that will allow us to keep fishing.
Mille Lacs finds itself in a difficult situation. Tests done last year prompted the DNR and tribes that also fished the lake to cut in half the total amount of walleye that can be harvested from the lake, from 500,000 pounds last year to 250,000 pounds this year. Of that, sport anglers get roughly 180,000 pounds of walleye, and it's up to the DNR to make sure anglers stay within that limit. But that could be tricky this year. Last year, sport anglers caught more than 300,000 pounds of walleye on Mille Lacs. To stay within its limits, the DNR's Jones says this year, anglers will only be able to keep a narrow window on the walleye they catch, perhaps only ones between 18 and 20 inches long. Beyond what needs to be done this season, Jones says it's trying to let the lake's walleye population recover.
The worst case we'd like to see would be having to switch to catch and release. We'd rather not see that, but if we had to switch to something, we'd rather switch to that than shutting down the fishery.
Jones says the agency will probably liberalize regulations that promote the fishing of bass and pike that prey on young walleye. Mille Lacs and fishing, especially walleye fishing, is a major economic driver for this part of central Minnesota. At the meeting last night, resort owners, guides, and other business owners around the lake expressed their concerns about this season's coming regulations. Josh Bullivant works as a fishing guide and self-appointed jack-of-all-trades at McCoy's Inn and Isle.
Yeah, it's going to stink. It's going to hurt us. But on the flip side, we're still going to be able to catch fish. I mean, it still looks like it's going to be still good fishing.
Bullivant says things could get especially bad if anglers exceed their limit and the DNR has to implement catch and release.
For some people, I mean, the walleye is the filet mignon. I mean, that's our state fish. That's what everyone comes up here to catch, is something to eat. So, I mean, yeah, some people may frown on just being able to catch and release.
At the same time, he says, there aren't a lot of places where you can go and catch so many fish, even if you can't keep them all. Susie Fisher Anderson owns Fisher's Resort. She's a little more direct about her thoughts about the upcoming walleye season.
If the fish are biting in the beginning and they can still keep a couple, I think we'll be okay. But if we go to catch and release, it'll be devastating.
Fisher Anderson says if the DNR promotes catching other fish, like bass and pike, as the agency suggested Wednesday night, that could offset some of the business she's anticipating losing from walleye.
If they, you know, are tired of walleye fishing, they're not keeping much, well, let's go try to get some smallies. You know, not everyone around here eats smallies, but there are people from other states that do eat smallies, so it might help with that.
Whatever's decided, it's critical the DNR stay within its harvest level. Don Pereira, a research biologist with the DNR, says if the state goes over the limit, not only would anglers be killing too many walleye, but they'd be exacerbating the population's decline. Already, he says, next year there will be a decline.
Because we don't have enough fish coming up in those younger ages to replenish the fish that we're taking. We're still in a declining state.
The DNR will announce walleye regulations on Mille Lacs before the season opener in May. Tribal and DNR biologists also plan to do a more detailed census study this spring.
That's Conrad Wilson near Lake Mille Lacs. I'm Phil Picardi here at the NPR studios in St. Paul. Thanks for listening to the NPR News Update. News on your schedule for the month of March, beginning tomorrow, right here.